You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. I heard the sounds of the water first, the rough slapping of the small soft drops, the loose atomic slush thrown upward, sizzling in a diamond dust, retracting, retracing, a hissing, a collapse. The sound of settling even, of the drowning out and drawing back of the sound itself, of retreat and self-silencing. Behind that, seagulls, and the humming rattle of a boat engine. And finally, I released my absorption, or absorption itself released me. There was a smell of brine, of dead fish, and I was back in the identified moment, in the spot of existence. Loose sheets of grey light and indigo slowly cleared, and I saw that we were looking out over a vast grey ocean. Mr. Graves was sitting on a deck chair, baffled with exhaustion. There had been no sleep the previous evening, and not much before that. After finishing his briefing on the coming end of days, he had gone immediately to his room to prepare. There had been documents to notarize, papers to finalize and seal, phone calls made. So exercised was I by all that had been said and proposed that I lost hold of my indifference and was dropped back to the dungeon floor. I lay with my foot in the awful stream, trying to gather my resources. I had no time for the drama of such inflammations. My excitement and worry upon hearing Errol McCluskey's name, my confusion around Mr. Graves' apocalyptic pronouncements, all were very gently and slowly let loose into the numbing darkness. I turned my attention from the explosions inside me to the quiet rim of emptiness and silence that held all in place. There was only one thing that needed doing now, and only one way to do it. No matter the content of Mr. Graves' experience, I needed to remain aloof, cold, receptive, non-judging, disinterested. Otherwise, I would be spending a good deal of my time in the dungeon. Gloomy batons of fatigue waved through his tired body. He badly needed sleep, and yet he was in no mood to consent to such laziness. A book lolled in his hands, and a sheaf of paper on his lap shuffled in the strong breeze. There was the slow horse movement of the ocean, of rising and falling and sidling and jilting down, of a broken four-legged shambling, yet something of the air of being blown across. Mr. Graves' hands were cold, too cold to write, too cold to read. But he left them out stranded on his lap, as though to punish them for failing to stay warm. He drowsed, but like a man on a bus who needs to stay awake in order to remember to deboard, he continually shook himself awake. I could not tell whether he sensed me alongside him. At first, I felt quite certain that my installation was unnoticed, but as my occupation persisted, I began to grow suspicious. It seemed too easy. By his own account, Mr. Grave had spent his life training to keep me locked in the buckle of his thought. Perhaps he was letting me be. Perhaps this was part of the plan. And what was his plan? To go to Westbrook Station as the world was ending? To kill Errol McCluskey and ensure that a Bilderberg was the only one on board the strange capsule as the world went into a hot dust? And what then? How much more of the story was inaccessible to me? A sailor stood at the railing down the gangway, smoking and looking out. He wore a large coat and a rolled hat. His face was haggard and as thickly crevassed as the bark of a tree. His long life, squinting into the sun, into the aggravating salt air, into the witch-away sea winds, had left him looking crossed out, scribbled to darkness, somehow nearly faceless. "Almost there," he called out without care. He turned, but did not approach. He drank from the cigarette a final time and drove it into the invisible air. "Almost where?" Mr. Grave prompted. "Franz Josef Land. We go as far as Rudolfa Island. That's where we leave ya." "How long will that take?" Mr. Grave asked. 9 hours, the sailor guessed. He turned away to light another cigarette and took the opportunity to walk in the direction of his turning. Mr. Grave tightened his hands over the papers on his lap. He leaned forward and groaned upward into standing, acknowledging the fact that he would need sleep for the coming days. The packet of islands north of Siberia is known collectively as the Franz Josef Land. Rudolfa Island sat on the edge of the permanent ice shelf of the Arctic Ocean. It was a transition point, the place where the boat stopped, where the wet water of the sea met the hard ice of the shelf. My long-ago time at Fort Alert on Ellesmere Island had taught me much about the northern geographies. Mr. Grave moved uneasily over the deck. He gripped the papers and the book under one arm, and his right hand slid along the cold and wet metal rail. He was not used to the world bobbing and dancing away from him, and his old legs and sense of balance were reluctant to concede to what seemed the almost silly challenge of life aboard a ship. He pushed into an unseen door, and when he shut it, I was shocked by the strange, sudden, interior silence. The flooding rumble of the sea and tyrannical whistle of the wind had been put suddenly far away with the closure of a thin, metal door. The cabin was grimly dark and small, and smelled of vinyl. He sat down on the narrow bed and lay back. I could feel the sluggishness of his sleep tugging me like a tidal surge. His sleep was usually my own, and it was difficult not to succumb. But I would not. Whatever it took, I would not. I had one small task set before me. To stop Mr. Grave from killing Errol McCluskey. The only way I could do that was to take hold of his body, if only for an instant. So it was that as he slept, I began to creep my way along the strange, unexplored corridors of his body, fumbling over the tiny threads of sinew and ligament, down the electric channels and tendrils and impulses, searching for something to grab hold of, some hot wire to control, so that I might, when the time came, take the reins. Thank you. When I was a boy, I deeply and sincerely believed that I was capable of all manner of extrasensory performance. At the root of this was a supreme confidence in my innate ability to move objects. Telekinesis felt as natural a process as breathing, not so much a talent or skill as a relationship that one could choose to cultivate, if one so chose. A sensed unity between the outer and inner world. Though I was not able to move a single object with the power of my mind, I regardless spent a good deal of my free time staring at marbles or stones or leaves, attempting to make them roll, slide, or scuttle. I knew, with the purest integrity of a child's absolutism, that I could do such things, but somehow I had forgotten the means. It was as though the telephone were ringing before me, and I was like a gorilla slapping at its sides. That I had forgotten how to lift the handset from the cradle. Such was the power of my belief in my own ability to finalize the arrangement that I never left off the conviction that it was possible. And now, as Mr. Graves slept, as I searched the tremulous wiring of his body, trying to take charge of it, I remembered my old passionate and naive pursuits into the world of mentalism. I was surprised to find that my method had not changed. As a 10-year-old boy, trying to move a box of matches, I had brought both deep conviction and yet a cessation of willfulness, along with a becalmed dissolution of my own identity, that I might merge toward the box of matches and become one with it. And in so doing, I foresaw that some cleansing final juxtaposition would allow the object standing just outside the reach of the ornament of my body to become like a disconnected but functioning appendage. Moving the box of matches should prove, I felt, like moving my own hand, however remote and disconnected from my bloodstream. And yet, as I said, there was never any experience of success. For a while I concentrated my energy on Mr. Graves' eyes, trying to open them or cause some kind of flutter. But I quickly realized that his autonomic system was vigorously opposed to my infiltration. His eyes were drawn shut by the black lock mechanics of sleep. I turned my attention to his loose fingers. I tried to enter them as gloves and tried to lightly move a finger back and forth. I grew more comfortable. I felt there was some access here, some yielding, as though despite the fact that the fingers were not moving, they were preparing for their compliance, as though reorienting themselves to the notion of a new captain. But my efforts were abruptly halted. There was a knock at the door, and the smoking, wrinkled sailor leaned his haggard face in. "They've gathered for supper in the meeting hall." "Gathered already," Mr. Graves said. He sat up, rubbing his eyes. I receded quickly, dropping into stillness behind my curtain. It was middle-late evening. The skies were clear and unclouded, but dusk was so well advanced there was a grey suggestion of storminess. Mr. Graves followed the sailor along the gunmetal deck, through the narrow passages of the ship. We entered finally into an open rotunda just below the main bridge and chart room, and descended a central staircase, and entered the galley. As we did so, a group of possibly 100 or so young men and women stood to attention, and then burst into applause. "I take it you are all quite ready for the coming polar travail," Mr. Graves said, in a tone far more congenial than any I'd heard from him yet. He gazed over the beaming young faces and forced a cheery smile. I hoped that Mr. Grave would, before the supper began, give some brief speech that illuminated the bizarre scene and perhaps explained the presence of these young persons. But he quickly took his seat at a main table, and, as before, my curiosity was building as my eagerness for explanation got the better of me. I dropped back into the dungeon, where I once again quickly set about putting my excitements to rest. Who were these young people? What had they to do with this final push toward Westbrook? I could not know the answer. The answer was not within me, and there was no urgency for me to know it now. Such explications do little to the anxious mind, but they are a first step away from the wildfire of thought. When I next roused into Mr. Graves' awareness, it was to the sound of footsteps on the hard blanket of snow and ice. It was a brilliantly sunny morning, The boat had evidently arrived and its passengers debarked. Mr. Grave was walking steadily down the rocky crags of what I presumed was Rudolpha Island. The frozen wasteland of the Arctic Shelf extended its white, lifeless plateau before us. We came along a series of makeshift buildings, each thickly slathered with frost on their windward side, before descending down a steep path toward the shelf proper. The group of young people were visible on the far distant ice, already streaming in a black line out toward a row of distant vehicles. The children, as I now thought of them, were carrying suitcases and satchels in hand, some wore backpacks. Despite the frigid air and the steady Arctic winds, I could, nevertheless, hear their light-hearted tones. There was laughter and loud happy talking from their ranks, as though they were all heading off for some long-imagined tropical vacation. The 10 or 12 black vehicles ahead, I supposed, would serve as our final means of transport to the Westbrook station. As he stepped from the island onto the shelf, Mr. Grave lowered an additional polarizing lens over his snow goggles to block out the excessive ice glare. I wrestled myself to my indifference. Urgent questions, great and small, rose and fell in my mind as we traversed the icy scalp and made our way to the large, black, unstyled snow cruisers and their enormous wheels. I felt I could not risk an additional return to the dungeon. I needed to stay with Mr. Grave now and keep my interest in check. As the questions came, I ignored them. I concentrated instead on the brilliant white light of the sun. I listened to the wind as it howled. As he continued his approach, he watched his young charges split into small groups of 10 or so. They moved to the back end of the snow cruisers and began to load their cargo into the large, open holds at the back. After this, they entered. It was as Mr. Grave stepped into his cruiser and signaled the driver to commence the voyage that I finally understood. As the engine fought against the vehicle's enormousness, and Mr. Grave took a windowless seat in the main cabin among the cheery handful of young men and women, I realized who they were, and I was stunned that I had not recognized the fact at once. Of course, these were the Bilderberg children. And here we all together were, as though on a great bus trip at the end of time, heading off into the giddy, surreal dissolution of the world. I found that, against my own will, I had fallen asleep when Mr. Grave had. My worthy inner revolution, my goal of finding a way to overthrow his governance, had fallen away in this simple need for sleep. We woke as the snow cruiser came to a choppy halt. "What is it?" Mr. Grave called. "We're at the margin," the driver called back. Mr. Grave stood dutifully up. He moved into the front cabin and gazed out the window. It was bright stars and blackness, the middle of the night. Mr. Grave choked at a sigh, both tired and resistant to his next step. 6 hours till light, sir," the driver said, unprompted. Mr. Grave dressed. Several underlayers were finally sealed over by a large snow outfit, which was equipped at the back with a battery-operated heating unit. The driver turned this on, and I almost immediately sensed the warming coils fire to life all around. "This will heat for 4 hours, more or less, and we're 9 miles out. Should take you 2 hours on the skis, maybe a little more for the wind, and if any clouds come in, the darkness will be a menace." The driver stepped down and opened the snow cruiser door. A few moments later, Mr. Grave was standing on skis outside in the blasting Arctic air. The stars above us glistened whitely in the shoe-black of space, as though exploding with some final emphasis. Mr. Grave gazed down over the dark line of snow cruisers, each containing a driver and perhaps a dozen sleeping passengers. The Bilderberg children would remain here. Mr. Grave would go on ahead. He would go on ahead, and when it was safe, whatever that meant for him, he would signal the drivers, and they would complete the final leg of the journey. The first few strokes in the skis were awkward as he transitioned his legs from the staccato of walking to the glissade of the skiing mode, but he very quickly adjusted and was soon speeding across the ice. The combination of his own heat and that of the battery-powered heater contained in his snowsuit was still not quite a match for the occasional large sweeping sword of wind, which cut right through Mr. Graves' specialty clothing and simply cancelled whatever heat it found. For those moments, it was as though he was rendered naked on the ice. It was the pure cold air on his skin. Luckily, these enormous throat-cutting winds were irregular, and between their fierce swipes, he regained enough heat to bear forth without much trouble. I believe he was navigating by means of a certain star, as he did regularly glance upward and ahead, and thereupon slightly adjust his heading. It had been nearly 30 years since I had been to Westbrook. Errol McCluskey would be, almost, an old woman. I wondered if she would have remembered me at all, by sight if she had seen me, by name if she had heard it. Or was I simply an unknown party, a long-ago brief encounter, an unimportant face, the man who replaced her at Westbrook all those long years ago? It seemed to me that the fact of my great attention and interest in her would have created some opposite condition in herself, that the more I recollected her and the stronger I felt, the less feeling she would have for me. Mr. Graves stopped. He hung down for a moment over the ski poles, breathing hard his exhaustion, before twisting first his right, then his left foot sharply, and stepping out of the skis. He dropped the poles carelessly. The next gust of wind lifted one ski and sent it flipping into the distance. The poles rolled and rattled and then tumbled away. The remaining ski sat for a moment, shuddering as the winds poured over it, fighting for its place, before it too launched backwards and disappeared into the darkness. Mr. Grave walked over the ice unsteadily. His muscles were tensed and elongated from the skiing. He fumbled his thick glove around in a large pocket of his snowsuit and extracted a flashlight. Shining it ahead, I saw perhaps 40 yards in the distance, the little fishing shack where I'd first met Errol McCluskey. For so flimsy a seeming thing, it was remarkably intact. Mr. Grave went inside. He quickly found the small gas heater below the bench on the floor and toggled it on. It was both the only heat and light we would have. He sat on the bench in the grimy, orange light. He had been here before. I could tell by his comfort, by his lack of searching. He removed his gloves and drew back his hood and loosened the wet and partially frozen face mask. On a shelf above the door, with 3 cans of chicken soup. He took a can down and set it directly on the gas heater grate, and 5 minutes later had cut the can open and was holding it in his gloved hand, spooning the hot liquid into his coldly tight mouth. And then he sat in the warm glow for perhaps 30 minutes, resting and recovering. When he was done with the soup and adequately heated, he stood. His hand fumbled in the darkness of the near wall. In the failing orange light from the heater, I barely discerned the handset of a telephone. He placed the handset against his ear, and I listened as it rang. He had dialed no number. This was a direct access line to the station itself. It was 3 or 4 minutes before the ringing stopped, and a crackling flare of static was followed by a familiar voice. "Hello?" Errol McCluskey said, in a tone both sleepy and stern. "It's me, Errol," Mr. Graves said. "It's Sherwin. Would you be so kind as to let me in?" "I'm running to the door now. Come in, come in," she said with sudden excitement, and hung up. Mr. Graves was racing out the shack. About 80 yards ahead, climbing into the starry sky, was an enormous ice wall. Attached to this, I remembered, a cold and frost-feathered stairwell zigged and zagged its way up to the Westbrook entrance. In the dark, forbidding space above, a golden square of light flared. Mr. Graves hastened forward. As his feet hit the stairwell, I listened to the ringing clang of each step. I set my attention on the cold air on his face and the hot space in his chest. I felt his tired arms clutching at the rail. I listened to what could be heard and saw what could be seen, as I felt I would have only one chance. And if it was not now, quite likely it would never be. She stood shivering on the upper balcony. I saw the faintest, brightest smile. In a long robe and a heavy hat, her bird-like voice calling my name, "Sherwin, Sherwin." And despite the cold, she was already reaching forward to embrace me. Mr. Graves took the final flight of stairs, accelerating as he did, and with his last bit of energy, I felt his intention. Errol McCluskey would be dead in the next few moments if I could not follow my imperative. I dropped all claims and fully impelled myself into the peripheral space. I was no one and nowhere once again, but yet in doing all this, I demanded from the universe one slight application of gesture, the simplest alteration of trajectory. And as Mr. Graves' foot hit the top balcony and his arms reached out toward her neck, and as Errol McCluskey's beautiful face opened to meet us in the dark fullness of that moment, I threw myself, the full weight of whatever I had been, into a pendulum force that rocked Mr. Graves' body onto the balcony railing and spun him out and over into space. He tumbled and sped headlong downward the 80 feet toward the ice, and I felt a waiting, deep content of my own imminent evanescence. I would be leaving now. I was going soon, and the sudden nothingness I would feel would be her safety. The body struck hard into the ice, and I felt the bones shatter and the blood surge in loose pools into the lungs and heart. There was weak thought and no feeling from the impact, no pain, just the memory of hitting. We lay in the dying state on the ice, waiting. I heard the clang of Errol's footsteps. She was coming down the stairs as quickly as she could. Mr. Graves' hand twitched, and he blinked upward into the stars. "Goodbye, Mr. Graves," I said. I was still following along the path of the death spiral when I realized that Mr. Graves had pushed himself into standing. Errol McCluskey had halted some 20 feet away, stunned to find not only a living person, but a well-seeming one. "It's good to see you, Errol," Mr. Graves said. As he raised his arms to embrace her, and the look of shock on her face turned to terror, I finally understood why I was there, the reason I'd been brought along. We'll be right back. been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.